Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Washington State Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedahl was born and raised in Snohomish and is the youngest of eight children. He graduated summa cum laude from Washington State University with a bachelor's degree in social studies and earned a master's degree in public administration from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He coached both youth and adult soccer, volunteered as a local city planning commissioner, and served as a trustee for the College Spark Washington Foundation. His professional career has been devoted to public education. Chris has worked as a high school history teacher, local school board member, state legislator, and budget and education policy executive for our state's community and technical college system. In November 2016, Chris was elected as Washington's 16th state superintendent. Chris and his wife Kim lived in historic Tumwater with their two children, Carter and Kennedy. Superintendent Rakedahl, you recently released your budget priorities based on two surveys of the public in Washington State. What was the survey process, and what did you hear?
Well, we went out twice, and the first one was really all about trying to understand maybe where the larger public interest was. So it was broad. It went to, I think, 30,000 folks ultimately filled it out. We distributed that through a lot of channels. We asked them a lot of large categories of priority, and seven or so really rose to the top. So we went out with a second round and said, of those seven now, if you had a bunch of money to spend on those, if you had new investment, how would you prioritize those? The surveys were very consistent, although I would say a little more balanced in the second one. The first one clearly had these things that arose, comprehensive supports and mental health supports and school safety and facilities and things like that. By the second survey, when we were asking them to apply money to it, there was definitely a tighter balance between those things. The great news is it was consistent with where we wanted to go, but we didn't want to go very far without having the voice of the public and to really affirm where we were thinking alike. And then if they had some new concept that we weren't really aware of, we wanted to incorporate that. So fortunately, it was very consistent. It allowed us to write a budget request almost exclusively to their priorities.
Really?
Truthfully, our budget is very heavy on funding for students with disabilities, which elevated high. Comprehensive supports, so counseling, mental health, nurses, and then school safety elements and school facilities. That's a separate budget from the operating budget, but we really beefed that thing up significantly in the request. So, you know, we feel like this is sort of the voice of the public. It's where we wanted to go. That's the confident thing. The harder part, of course, is it's new money in an era where some people still believe that education was funded, so what are we doing? And right. I have to constantly remind folks that a court case was solved. That was about very basic funding, but problems persist, inequities persist, and we have to do some things differently and invest in more targeted ways to get better outcomes.
So when you surveyed the public, do you feel like you've got a pretty good cross-section of most of the stakeholders, parents, students out there, different communities?
I think it's always difficult because you have all these mediums you can attempt, and some are pretty affordable and others are not. It certainly wasn't sent to a third-party firm who does really good work in sampling. Ours was very aggressive in social media, and it originates from here, so it already has an implicit bias of educators. We control for that a little bit by balancing them. So if two-thirds of the survey was filled out by teachers, we put that in context, and we give them a certain weight, but then we look at that compared to folks who have nothing to do with education. And again, that was what was refreshing about this is how consistent they were in responses. Mm-hmm. The second time around, we asked for race, ethnicity, and some other background information. Again, underrepresented always by second language learners, I would say communities of color. Yeah. Harder to get at issues of poverty or privilege, but generally these survey tools underrepresent there as well.
How did you communicate your budget priorities back to the people who took the survey? Did you close the loop?
Well, we will. The first thing we had to do is get it sent to OFM. We did that last week. We had a big public press event where we talked about not only the investments that we want, but also some revenue ideas on how to try to balance our tax code a little bit. Then this process begins, which really just started last Thursday or Friday, where we go out to all the stakeholder groups in the state and say, here's our budget, here's the detail. Mm-hmm. And one of those will be the email list that we were able to build as a result of the survey. And I don't remember if it was 6,000 or 7,000 emails, but there's a pretty robust list now. Our budget requests will go back out to them and sort of thank them and honor them for the work they did. And hopefully they'll see reflected in our request some of the big priorities.
That's great. And two of the priorities that you have in there are big ones for League of Education voters. That would be the comprehensive supports and also the funding for special education. Can you talk a little bit more about both of those?
I always come back to the legislative interest, and they wanted to solve a court case, and they wanted to shift our cost model to state dollars and away from local levies, which is great, and it's exactly what they should do in terms of the basic ed bucket. Mm-hmm. But we saw districts for decades having to supplement things like counselors and nurses and special education and even school facilities. When you think about what does it mean to go to a campus and see that it's mowed and that it's painted and that it's cleaned,
Yeah. Those
are often very heavily reliant on local levies. So on one hand, we're telling the legislature, you got to go balance that levy question a little better. Districts still need that. On the other hand, we're telling the legislature, but it's still not appropriate for them to use levy to fund basic ed. And special education, for example, without question, every dollar of it should be basic ed. And so we've given them a different approach that says create an incentive, invest more money, but do it in a way that actually reinforces the research. And the research focuses on inclusive practices. Do the professional development of gen ed teachers so they understand how to work more effectively with a student with a learning disability in their main gen ed classroom, as opposed to sort of the isolation models we've seen for decades.
Yeah.
So our approach actually gives a financial incentive to do that. A district would now get more dollars if they kind of follow the best research models. There are still reasons for students to have very intensive support, sometimes one-on-one, whether it's language or speech or behavior or something else. And there's still financial incentive to do that very well and very effective, we think. But what we're trying to do is, if you will, sort of hollow out that middle where there are these students, and maybe it's a reading disability, who absolutely, in the least restrictive environment, would be in a gen ed classroom with additional supports. For a very long time, they've been pulled out and isolated. And so we're trying to get rid of that practice and really focus on gen ed classrooms and inclusion, and beef up the supports for those really intensive needs.
Now, is there a way to guarantee that the money would get to where it's supposed to go? Would it have guardrails, or would it be more of an allocation model? Because that's one of our concerns, that it gets allocated and then it gets kind of lost.
Yeah, so that's part of the transformation of this budget request, is we're telling the legislature that future investments, now that basic ed's been funded, if you will, the court has signed off on it, they have to keep better control of their next sort of generation of investments to make sure that they're focused on those things. So this model collects data from districts and says you're going to get the money based on the actual performance of where students are served, for one, so that's a good guardrail. The nursing money, the counseling money, the other stuff we're looking at in comprehensive supports, we really want to go to ratios, like class size, where essentially the request of the legislature is you should put the money where you intend it to go, and you should put some rules around that, and districts would only be eligible for the money if they actually invest in those professionals. And we think that's just the future. When legislature and the public says we want counselors, we should have counselors. And when they want more nurses, we should have nurses. And I got to say, that can work from a public policy standpoint. There's still a market reality. It is hard to find nurses right now. It is hard to find some of these professionals. So there's still this parallel question of how do you make sure the compensation's effective and the recruitment practices are effective to get them to work in our schools.
Are there other budget priorities, if you were to pick one, that you're most excited about besides comprehensive supports and special ed?
Well, in a budget, you love all your children equally. So so not necessarily. I will say this, though. On the capital budget, we're trying to be really innovative. We've had this model for a very long time where district passed bonds, and we think at a ridiculously high 60% level, we want to simplify that to 50%.
That's great.
But even so, you have these communities that are aggressively growing, and their values are growing. And so to them, passing a bond is pretty easy with respect to kind of the percentage of the local economy dedicated to it. And then they get all this matching money, so the state fills it up. Mm-hmm. And outside of a few things the state doesn't pay for, or athletic fields and all that, we match it. And so districts who want to build really extravagant facilities, and sometimes they want that, are getting lots of money. If you're in rural Washington and you can't pass a bond, or when you do, you're so property poor, you can't even replace classroom space adequately, those districts have been starved. So the model still incents everyone to take risk locally. We've got a new concept that builds a very specific prioritized list for rural districts and property poor districts. And we just think if we are one state focused on each kid equally and equitably, you have to start shifting some of that money to lower income communities on their capital space so they have learning facilities that mirror the best in the state.
All right. So how can we, as education stakeholders, parents, community members, educators, leaders, how can we help make this happen?
Well, I always say stay close to your school, right? Some people say, well, how in the heck do I influence the legislature? Well, those models are still there, right? Email them, call them, go to forums, you know, make your priorities known. Don't let up on the gas pedal of education, because a court case was solved, but the needs of basic ed for kids and students who are really experiencing learning gaps and opportunity gaps, that's not transformed at all in the new plan. Right. And we have to do that. So keep pushing hard for the basic ed dollars and beyond. And then I'd say stay close to your district. Your district has a set of priorities that we think we've captured mostly. Some of them will say, my solution needs to come from more levy, or my solution needs to come from special ed. So if you want a tailored message in your community, really meet with your local school board, your local superintendent. Make sure you know of the menu we've created, what the biggest priorities are. We don't need everybody pushing on all 15 aspects or whatever. We need them pushing on the thing that works for them. And it'll be a little different from community to community. But I'd say keep pushing hard, stay close to your local community, and then take risk. There is a part of the proposal here that asks the legislature to stop relying so aggressively on state property taxes. And while that's always been hard to do in our state, we think it is timely and more equitable. Candidly, would give some property tax relief to a lot of people in the Puget Sound.
Chris Rakedahl is the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Rakedahl, thank you so much for letting me drop by.
Thank you. Anytime you want to talk, I'm available.